welcome to a very respectful episode of Modern Day Philosophers. That's right, I'm paying respect to my guest, the now sadly late, great Joe Franklin. People knew him as a pioneer, as a broadcaster, as a legendary talk show host. I knew him as a friend and as somebody who gave me a lot of stage time starting out at his restaurant in the back room of Joe Franklin's Memory Lane, named for his radio show, Joe Franklin's Memory Lane, which came after the Joe Franklin Show and many other. I mean, if you look up Joe Franklin, if you don't know who he is, he was a staple of New York. He was a legendary character of New York City. He was a broadcaster for many years. He claims to have interviewed 500,000 people, and that might not be an exaggeration if you knew him. I've talked about him before on the show, definitely with Mike Cirklin, who also started out there, and with Louis Black, who I told a story to about a psychic that I met in Joe Franklin's office. But his office, if you haven't seen it, and it's been in films like The Aristocrats and all kinds of stuff, it was just this place in Times Square. It was this magical place with just mountains of memorabilia piled up everywhere around him, and you pull like one thing out and it would all fall down, towers of records and books and photographs and who knows what else would just fall down. He had people in the office who I think were hired just to constantly restack stuff, and somehow he had a generally pretty good idea of where everything was. That's a miracle. I have no idea how that was even possible. And his office was filled with the most eclectic, eccentric characters. All these showbiz groupies. Joe Franklin, I don't know where he would find. I know he found some of them in coffee shops around Times Square. And he'd say, come on, come and hang out in the office. Come hang out. Love to have you. I don't know where else. People were fans of his TV show. People were just fans of his. He was just a truly sweet, nice guy and a supportive guy, and I'm sad that he's gone. He lived a good long life, though. At least that much I can say. He died at 88 years old this week, and he interviewed everybody, as you'll hear me talk to him about, from Charlie Chaplin to Marlon Brando to just about every showbiz great that you can possibly think of. At one point, John Lennon and Yoko Ono were on his show a lot. Everybody did Joe Franklin's show. And he was a one of a kind. He really was. There's nobody like Joe Franklin, and I doubt there ever was. Though I can't see the entire history in front of me of the world. I don't think there was ever somebody quite like Joe Franklin. So he was one of my very first interviews when I started getting into broadcasting, and I may have got the very last interview with him, which is what you're about to hear, and we recorded it a few months ago, right after my big asthma attack that you've heard me talk about a few episodes back, the Susie Essman one. The next day, I interviewed Joe Franklin, which was also very difficult for me to laugh. You may notice in the episode that I felt bad because he made a lot of great jokes, and I was just trying not to laugh the whole time because it triggers the asthma. And when I did laugh, it was kind of like a canned laughter. It wasn't because I didn't think he was funny. It was because I didn't want to really let myself laugh and trigger the asthma. But that's, I don't know if I even need to explain that to you, but I feel like I should. So there you go. It's been explained. Okay, today's show is brought to you by Stand Up Records. Take a listen to what they have to say.
Imagine a world where no one ever went hungry, where you didn't have to choose between clean air and clean water, and where bitter, drunken comedians didn't have to work in small, dark clubs to tell you how severely screwed up everything is. If that kind of world scares you the way it scares us, then we can help. We're standuprecords.com. We offer the finest in CDs, DVDs, and merchandise from the best stand-up comedians on earth. So please give generously, and remember, together we can't save the world. Yeah, no, we can't. So you may as well just buy something funny. That's standuprecords.com.
There you have it, Dan Schlissel and Stand Up Records. Quality people. You can go pick up my album, Some Kind of Comedian, which will be released on vinyl in a limited run soon. If you want to reserve one, you could always email me at thecomical@yahoo.com, or you could also email me to say hello, say what's up, tell me how you're doing, introduce yourself, follow up. Keep an ongoing email back and forth with me as I've been very honored to have with some of you, and I appreciate that. The website is moderndayphilosophers.net, where you can make a donation. Please go do that. That would be great. Need that. Count on it. Rely on it. Appreciate it. I am back from my trip to the Holy Land. I am snowed into New York right now. Stopped over here for a few days. My parents threw a very nice engagement party for Kylie and I, and we had a wonderful time. And we were supposed to fly back to LA today, but we are surrounded by these beautiful white sheets of snow all over Long Beach, and there ain't no planes flying out today. I don't know why I went into that weird voice, but there aren't any. There aren't any planes flying out today. You'll hear a little bit of Kylie at the beginning of the interview because I let it roll a little bit. I let the audio roll just to capture the ambiance of being in Joe Franklin's office. And I also left in all the phone calls that came in, though I cut out, you know, the meat of the phone call because that was, you know, whatever it was, would be private between Joe and whoever's calling. But I wanted you to get that feeling of how his phones were always ringing. He always had two phones going at the same time. These landlines with cords on them, those coiled cords. And so I left that whole experience of just being in Joe Franklin's office. You got to imagine I'm there. I'm in Times Square. Kylie's there. There's a bunch of these different Joe Franklin groupies that are there. There's an ongoing dialogue about hot chocolate. They're all trying to get hot chocolates going at the same time throughout the interview. There's phone calls coming in. And there's me and Joe, surrounded by these piles and mountains of Joe's memorabilia, sitting there and having this very lovely talk. So, without further ado, except for the intro song, here's my talk with my very recently departed friend, the one and only, the legend, the pioneer, the man who started it all, Mr. Joe Franklin. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Right, so where's the other hot chocolate? Where's the other hot chocolate?
If he wants a hot chocolate?
Yeah, let him have it. Then you and I split this one, right, Wally?
Yeah, right. Okay.
You got the extra cup?
Okay, I have to get a cup. I thought you were okay.
How are you going to get a cup now? It's impossible, right? You find it, Wally? You find it?
If I can have a cup in 3 minutes.
Nah, you got to have a cup here somewhere, Wally. Somewhere is a cup. You lifted up the red jacket, Wally?
There's a cup right up there also.
How are you going to get there, Wally?
All right, so he just had it.
That Philadelphia cup?
There's no way to get up now, Wally. You know that.
Okay. So you
lifted up the red jacket, Wally?
I'll lift it up again.
It's against the wall. If you lift it up, you find the cup immediately.
Okay.
No luck, huh? I've written 23 books.
Wow.
You find it, Wally? There's no red jacket?
There's a burgundy.
Yeah, burgundy jacket. You want to help Miss take a fast look? If you toss aside a red jacket or a burgundy jacket, you see a cup immediately hidden behind the jacket against the wall. If you don't find it, then we forget about it. You see a jacket?
This one?
Yeah, what a detective. What a smart man Wally is, huh?
The alleyway's
stuff in it.
Here.
What's in there? Liquid?
Yeah.
Let's fill it in the garbage pail.
Throw it out?
Yeah. You're a good lady. God bless you, sweetheart. Thank you.
Want me to pour it? Half and half?
Yeah, would you pour it?
Yeah.
That's enough. Plenty. Okay, well, enjoy it. Let me try one cookie. Here, Wally, take that.
Can you pass Joe a cookie?
Let me try one cookie. Yeah. Thank you. Hello? Oh, Rick, how are you, Rick? Squeeze me in somehow, right? I'll call you Monday. Rick, God bless you, Rick. One more second. You appeared at my restaurant too, right? For a while, a couple times. You were very funny.
Thank you.
Ready? I am here with a man who started the talk show. A man who I owe a lot of my career to because I developed as a comedian in the back of his restaurant. I'm talking about the one and only, the legendary, and my good friend, Joe Franklin. How are you?
Well, Danny, I've been the mentor to even Bill Cosby and Eddie Murphy and Woody Allen and late Joan Rivers and maybe 10 more like that. But I'm proudest of the fact that I did begin you in this business, and I'm glad you're doing so well with your radio show, with your comedy appearances, and I take a little bow on what I've done with you and for you. It's a pleasure to be on your radio show right now.
Thank you, Joe.
Many stars, I'll be honest with you, many of the big stars who sang on my show, like Barbara Streisand, was my singer for about a year and a half, Bette Midler was. Many of them, they see me, they walk on the other side of the street, they don't want to be reminded of the days when they were broke. So I just ignore them like they ignore me. But
does it hurt you?
No, I had them first, that's my little bit of satisfaction.
And you never get insulted if they don't?
Nah, I never get insulted. I take everything in. I never get insulted in my life over anything. I've been hurt, I've been downgraded, and it's, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Who's that from? Can you see who's that from, just for curiosity? The name?
It doesn't say. No, it doesn't say.
No name, huh?
Heavy.
Thank you. Hello? Louie, I'm talking on the phone right now. I got a hot lead. I'll say hello to a friend of mine can you help somebody with a big hit record? Hold on one second. Danny Lobel, a very popular comedian. Hold on. I want to get him some exposure with his new record. Hello? Oh, baby girl, I love you so much. 1,000%. Now listen, what time getting back from the beach? What time getting back from the beach? About, call me at 5 sharp, promise? On the button, God bless you.
So,
I've never been offended. I've had people give me little raps here and there, and I live with it. I take it. I absorb it. I'm still walking and talking. I'm still on Bloomberg Radio all over the world every day. This week I've got Lindsay Wagner, remember Bionic Woman?
Mm-hmm.
I got Barbara Eden. Remember Barbara Eden from I Dream of Jeannie?
Yeah.
I got Cyndi Lauper, who they say is making $500,000 a week on Kinky Boots, the Broadway show here.
Yeah.
I got Neil Sedaka. I got Paul Anker. I got Bobby Vinton. I get great guests. Oh, I got June Lockhart. Remember Lost in Space and Lassie? I get good people.
What do you think it is that keeps you interested after all these years in talking to people?
I think the main thing is, and that's a great question, Danny, I get the plug out right away. They're always worried they're going to miss the plug. If I get to the end of the show, will they not get their plug? I get the plug in fast. That puts them so at ease that I try and tantalize them and hypnotize them so I can get the best results from them. I get them to forget that they're on TV, that they're on radio, and the results have been startling. I had on TV, I had Ronald Reagan 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
I had Richard Nixon twice, I had Charlie Chaplin, I had John Wayne, I had Cary Grant, I had Frank Sinatra twice, I had Bing Crosby twice.
But what do you think it is about you that you're still so interested in talking to all these people? What do you attribute this thirst for this knowledge of other people to at this age?
Well, I'll tell you the real truth. I've used this line before. You got to believe me. It's a true line. The main ingredient for success, for longevity in my particular field, where the mortality rate is so staggering. There have been 500 talk show hosts came and went since I began. 500 talk show hosts came and went. 500. The answer is sincerity. And once you learn to fake that, then you got it made. You got to make believe. I'm really not that interested, but I pretend like I'm that interested. It seems to work. You know, you held on by the ratings. If the ratings go down in 1 week, you're off the air. 1 week, you're off the air. So far, I did maybe 65 years and never been dropped. When I left my old night radio show on WOR, Joe Frank's Memory Lane, I was the one who got tired. They were stunned when I left that show.
But I don't really believe that you're not interested. I don't think you are faking your sincerity because...
Well, you're right in a way. You're right. I'm a little bit facetious, but I do. I still have that curious way about me. I'm naturally interested in my guests. I am.
Why?
Well, I learn things, and I meet people every day. They say, Joe, I want to thank you for what you've done for me in the way of organizing my life, teaching me culture, Americana, nostalgia. I'm known as the king of nostalgia, you know.
I know.
I say king of neuralgia sometimes. My legs hurt a little bit today, but I'll be all right, I'm sure. It's just a matter of keeping up with the time. Keep on keeping on, and don't give up. And when I invented the talk show, I was picking the records for a man named Martin Block on a program called The Make Believe Ballroom on WNEW. Remember the name Martin Block? Vaguely, a little before your time, right?
Before my time.
So he was number one. He was first millionaire disc jockey. So he got me my own radio show. And one day I get a phone call I called that radio show Record Collectors Exchange because I was a fanatical record collector.
How old were you at the time?
I was about 17. And WABC, WJZ TV called me. It's WABC TV. Now WJZ TV called me and said, Joe, we'd like your voice on the phone. And we're considering lighting up in the daytime. There was no daytime TV yet in those days. TV was on the air then from about 5 o'clock at night till sermonette. So I said, well, I got an idea. How about I do a show of people talking, nose to nose, eyeball to eyeball, just talking. I said, Joe, you're out of your mind. You can't do a talk show on television. The word is vision. You got to give them seltzer bottles, pratfalls, baggy pants, burlesque kits, got beautiful, beautiful words. So I said, I defied them, in fact, Dan. I said, look, the rock and roll is coming in now. Kids are dancing to records all over the place. How about I do a show of kids dancing to records? They said, Joe, now we know you're really nuts. Who's going to watch kids dance to records? Who's going to look? Dick Clark?
American Bandstand.
American Bandstand. Yeah. He was a multi-billionaire. God rest his soul. He was a very dear friend of mine. So
that could have been you, but they turned that idea down.
Yeah, but I defied them anyhow. I just defied them. They gave me the hour anyhow, and I was did the world's first. No. You know who started the exact same day? The exact same day with me was Johnny Carson. He had a show on ABC on radio called Who Do You Trust? Either Who Do You Trust or Do You Trust Your Wife, one of those two titles.
Did you have a friendship with Johnny?
Very close. I was on a show about six times, and then when he was broadcasting it from New York City. He was very close. He was a nice man.
Was there any kind of sense of competition?
Nah, he was way ahead of me. He was national. I was just local. One time I was on his show. Somebody tapped him on the shoulder at the end and said, Johnny, nice job. They tapped him on the shoulder. He moved. He said, don't touch me. Don't never touch me. Never touch me. You couldn't touch the guy. But on the air, he was so cordial and friendly. But off the air, he was very cool and aloof. And
did you ever think about taking your show nationally?
I had the chance, and I didn't want to. I said, listen, I don't want to upset the tempo, the beat, the rhythm, the flavor. I want to keep it on a local basis, local flavor, local tempo. I didn't want to. I was just so happy. I was in a certain rut, but a certain groove. I was on TV three times a day.
Wow. Once,
morning, noon, and night.
And then, how did you keep that up? Wasn't that physically exhausting or mentally exhausting?
One of the three was taped, was repeat, but the other two were live, and I had some classic shows like the Jay Giles Band and the Ramones and all these fantastic groups through the years. And New Kids on the Block introduced. Garth Brooks I introduced. And Julia Roberts made her first appearance on my show. She was so pretty. She was 17 years old. And my best friend was Tony Curtis. I grew up on the same block in the Bronx with Tony Curtis. So we kept in touch till the very last days of his life. He was a great, great actor and a great guy.
Did you have relationships with any of these famous actresses over the years?
You mean personal?
Yeah.
Not a one. A couple that really excited me when they were sitting next to me on the air. I met someone that got me quite excited sitting next to them, but I never got around to meeting them off the camera.
Was that a conscious decision, or?
It was probably a conscious decision. I could have said, here's my number, you want to meet me, have a cup of coffee, have dinner with me tonight, but I never bothered. I never
I don't think many talk show hosts got that close with their guests.
Yeah.
But so that's a great question, by the way.
Thank you. Well, tell me about the years before you turned 17 and got on the air. What were you like as a kid?
Well, I went to school with Tony Curtis, and my father was in the paper and twine business. He did very, very well. He did very well during World War II. Even one paper bag was worth a fortune, so he did very well during the Second World War. And he wanted me to stay in that business with him, which I definitely considered, but when I got this chance to become the record picker for Martin Block, I was at WNEW there to have a date with the receptionist, and Martin Block walks out and says, you know, I just fired my record chooser, and who are you, kid? I said, my name is Joe Franklin. He said, how would you like to work for me? I said, I'd love that, Mr. Block, but I knew nothing about it. I didn't know Glenn Miller from Harry James from Tommy Dorsey.
Were you in high school?
Yeah, I was probably going to high school, you're right. So I met William B. Williams, the famous disc jockey. So I met him, and he gave me like an overnight crash course in music and bands, and I enjoyed that. I was his record chooser. He would say, Joe, go in the lobby, bring in Frank Sinatra, bring in Vaughn Monroe, bring in Bing Crosby, bring in Al Jolson. So it was education in music, and I just never did anything else since that moment in my entire life, but remained in the talk show field and the music business.
I think what distinguishes you from all the other talk show hosts is your incredible memory. And actually, the restaurant, wasn't it called Joe Franklin's Memory Lane, the restaurant? The
restaurant lasted there for about 12 years. We had many, many great highlights. The opening night, I think you were there, Danny, right? And I had David Letterman, I had Carol Channing, I had Tony Curtis, I had Captain Lou Albano, I had many, many celebrities, but it was... And the Reese brothers that owned, the Reese family that owned that restaurant, Dennis Reese especially, they lost their lease and the restaurant closed, but I have no regrets. I had 12 wonderful years in that restaurant.
We had a lot of fun in the back in that comedy room. You used to come and, you used to watch all the shows.
And do my own comedy. I had a good comedy act, you know.
You did. And you were always very supportive of me. You always gave me very nice.
You're one of my personal favorites, Dan. I'm so glad we're in touch again.
Me too.
You like California, huh?
California's great, yeah.
Better than New York, huh?
I don't know. I go back and forth because I miss New York, too. But
We miss you, but it's so nice that we're at least doing this radio show. I just did a one-hour where I did a big routine with Jerry Lewis, and who was there was... Everybody was there. Except Regis Philbin, wasn't there? I said, where's Regis Philbin? I said, he had a prior commitment. I was afraid he wasn't there, but everybody who had a name was there. Bill Boggs and Woody Allen and Sammy Davis, the manager whose name I forget, but all the big shots were there, and I... told Jerry Lewis, I got a little trouble with my knees. They're getting a little bit wobbly. He says, I got the same trouble, Joe. It's called age-related. It's called old age, so don't worry about it. It'll improve by itself. So that was consolation to hear that from Jerry Lewis.
Were you ever married?
Me? I was married to her. I had one wife. She died about 2 years ago. She died in Florida of MS, multiple sclerosis. That was a sad day in my life. But she had a good life. She had a good husband. I bought her a nice house. She had a nice boyfriend out there.
Yeah.
But... And I'll never remarry him. I had my share of that, but I've got a million great memories. My last book was called Up Late with Joe Franklin, sold 75,000 copies. And they're all in my house. It's now in its third printing. You know why? Because the first two printings were blurred. I'm not kidding.
What do you do to keep your memory sharp? Do you have tricks?
Not really. I just go to bed early and don't drink, don't smoke, don't curse.
Never drank, never smoked?
It's maybe a tiny sip of... Black Russian maybe once in a while, but I don't drink. I never stopped being nice to fans. Every place I walk in the street, they stop me for autographs and want to take a picture with me. And I get that 15, 20 times every single day of my life. I never turned anybody down. They say, Joe, you're so different from other people who run away from celebrities and curse at celebrities. They curse at those who bother celebrities. So it's just a question. I've learned to be nice.
Did you grow up in a big family? Do you have brothers and sisters?
My father was a journalist on a long-ago newspaper called the New York Mail, and he sat on the desk alongside Ed Sullivan about 1920. Ed Sullivan was a sports writer, and later on he turned to entertainment. But I had one sister who lives in Florida now, in Sarasota, very happily married. Married what they call a very wealthy man, so I wish I had that kind of wife or husband, but she's happy.
You still in touch?
Yeah, we talk about it at least once a month. She's very happy, got a lot of money. And I enjoy my old friendships. I hear on the phone now that people who were my friends 70, 75 years ago, they want to know, can they get in touch with me? I say, sure. Now, hold on for one second. Hello? Fred who? Fred, what happened, Freddie? Tell me. No, I'm holding my own, Freddie. It's getting a tiny bit better. I had a masseuse in here today. It's getting a tiny bit better. You know, I already saw too that. Yeah, Freddie, I love you for this phone call. Keep me close, Freddie. I miss you. Be good. I get about 300 phone calls a day. 300 a day. On a quiet day, maybe 250. So they
you like it, though, I think, right?
Well, some of them... One more second. Hello? Who's that? Yossi, when do I see you, Yossi? I'm being interviewed by a famous radio personality named Danny Lobel on the radio, but I miss you. You happy and healthy, kid? I'm going to stay home and sleep. You know what happened? I took a little flop. I one second. One second. Hello? Kevin, what happened? I know. I'm getting those. I really am. Yeah, I got people. Maybe you come by Monday and say hello to me, would you? Maybe. A what? Nah, I'll go there. One second. Hello? Who's this? Hold on, Ronnie. Yeah, so I really miss you, Ronnie. You're such a colorful guy. Try to make God bless you. I miss you. I love you. You're the best. Sorry, what were you saying?
I was saying you like getting all these phone calls, right?
I enjoy the music on the phone. I enjoy that ring, yeah, in a sense. I met the owner of the station last week, Michael Bloomberg. He's got $37 billion. I said, Mike, I got to work 6 weeks for that kind of money. He laughed like hell. He's the great, great man.
I've spent a lot of time in this office with you over the years.
That's right. I enjoyed every minute of it, every second of it.
Same here. And you've always got a very exciting, eclectic group of characters here. Psychics and vaudevillian acts that you don't meet them anywhere but here.
Hog callers, whistle twirlers, plate throwers, right? Everything.
And this office itself has its own life. It's very unique. And I'm sure you've been interviewed countless times about this office, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But I never really did get to ask you what it is that you love about surrounding yourself with so much stuff.
I've got Rudolph Valentino's coffee pot from 1926. I don't know, it's just, you know, when somebody dies, I get 12 local reporters come in here. When Robert Williams died, or Joan Rivers, or Jim Carter, or who else died really? Lauren Bacall, they all come in. My reaction, which I'm very happy to give, but I wish they'd give me a little retainer once in a while, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, how would you describe the office?
I would say that I know the order of my disorder.
Yeah.
I can 9 times out of 10 pick out, somebody says, Joe, give me a picture of Piper Laurie, give me a picture of Connie Stevens, give me a picture of Al Jolson, Eddie Cantor, Rudy Valley, Kate Smith, Fred Allen. 9 times out of 10, I can put my... I've got maybe 1 million photographs, got 1 million old record albums, got... sheet music, got lobby cards by the score. I've got my personal favorites are always Eddie Cantor and Al Jolson. I even like Georgie Jessel, remember? One bright and guiding light that taught me wrong from right. I found it in my mother's eyes. He was a big, big star.
And you collect all these things. I think you collect, you're a collector in general. You collect characters.
I still go collecting not only living, breathing characters, but I still go collecting weekends at flea markets and street fairs, and I pick up old movie theater programs, old Broadway show coupons. And
I think that's probably why you still interview people. It's all about collecting.
It's very, in a way, in a sense, that's very true. Very true, Danny.
Why do you think you like collecting so much?
It becomes an obsession, a hobby. I've had so many people want to buy things. They want to buy the whole collection outright for millions. I don't want to part with anything because I become what you call emotionally attached. I hate to part with any part of my archives. I get calls every day. People want to know, what can I buy this for? Can I buy that for? I say, no, it's not for sale right now. Call me next week. And next week, of course, never happens. But it's I just love it, and I'm very much attached to it, and I hate to part with it.
You know, I have this in common with you, because when I was a kid, I started collecting, and I had massive collections of all kinds of things, and they all got destroyed in Hurricane Sandy, unfortunately.
Ah.
But I had huge collections at my parents' house, And I thought about why.
What kind of record? What kind of memorabilia did you get? What kind of memorabilia was it in that?
I had all the old Beatles, the original albums on record. I had autographed photos of all the old comedians.
All gone down the drain with the Sandy, huh?
Everything gone. It was tragic. I had to shovel it up. It was all wet and destroyed. Mm. Imagine everything in this office, and I hope it never happens to you, but imagine if everything in this office was flooded. That's how it felt for me.
Terrible, terrible.
I just went in this whole childhood of collecting. I used to walk dogs and do anything I could to get money, and then I'd go to the garage sales and tag sales, and I'll tell you why I did it. Because I was afraid that when I was a kid, my dad's a photographer, and he used to always say, I'm going to leave you nothing but debt. So I was afraid, what am I going to do when I'm older if I don't make a living? I better have some stuff, a backup plan to cash in on. So I was like, I don't know what's going to be worth money, so I'll collect everything. War stuff, old watches, everything. I had a collection of everything, just in case one of those collections would be what saved me.
A true potpourri, right?
Yeah. And then, you know, I lost my backup plan in life. But I think I was afraid. That's why I was clinging on to all that stuff. I was afraid of how I'm going to survive in this world.
Daniel, whatever you see here, you can grab it by two hands and take it home with you. I'm serious.
You're so sweet, Joe, but... What do you think compelled you to collect all these years? Do you think it comes from the same thing as me?
It just happened in a funny way. I would ask my TV guests, listen, can I have a T-shirt? Can I have a tie clip? Can I have a old sweater? George Raft sent me a sweater. Ronald Reagan gave me one of his tie clips. Al Jolson gave me a pair of cufflinks. So I, 9 out of 10 said they wanted to give me things. Did not give me things, but many when they went home, they did send me. I had Shirley Temple on the air. They said, Joe... Be very careful with Shirley. She will not reminisce about her old movies. You can talk about her ambassadorship right now to Czechoslovakia, which she was the ambassador. You can talk about penal reform, women's rights, air pollution, but don't mention Shirley's old movies. So I said, I said to myself, how can I not mention Shirley's old movies? They're part of my life. I love Shirley's old movies. So we did 90 minutes talking about her old movies. She did not get up, did not go away. She smiled for the whole 90 minutes, and when she went back to California, she sent me one of her old scrapbooks, which is beyond value. So... I try to enchant them. I had Jane Wyman. They said, Joe, don't mention Ronald Reagan. They had a very unhappy divorce. I said, how can I not mention Ronald Reagan? He's the president of the United States. I did 60 minutes talking about Ronald Reagan. She didn't get it. She loved it. At her eyes.
Do you have archives of all these old interviews?
I say out of 28,000 shows, out of 500,000 guests, I say maybe 500 shows. That's all.
That's it?
A company called Historic Films that represent me on sound clips, sound bites, my old shows, but I was very...
That's sad.
I was careless. They like the same as on Johnny Carson's show, so they taped over the old shows to save money.
Yeah. Does it bother you?
It breaks my heart, but what can I do? Every day I get a phone call from someone, I say, Joe, my uncle was on your show in 1956, my grandmother was on your show in 1968, and I say, listen, you find it, I'll give it to you.
Maybe that's why you collect all this stuff, because you're afraid, you've lost so much already. You're afraid to lose anything else.
I got some tips, clips of me on a Conan O'Brien show, which I did when I was a kid. And I was the first guest on Conan O'Brien show,
a kid.
Yeah, sort of sort of giving the giving advice to the new kid on the block for the inventor of the... Joan Rivers began her own TV show on Fox, I was Joan Rivers' first guest on her Fox TV show, giving advice. So I've got a million memories like that, millions.
So maybe that's what it is. You just hold on to all this stuff because you've lost all your work.
Possible, very true.
I enjoy being around all your stuff. It's very interesting. And it adds it's a lot of character. It's a lot of who you are.
You know that Billy Crystal impersonated me for 4 years on Saturday Night Live? You know,
I Joe know, Frank, yeah.
4 years. First time I saw Billy Crystal as Joe Franklin. You know what I said? I said, Billy, one of us is lousy. You got a kick out of that.
Do you have a life outside of show business?
I doubt it. I'm an opening night critic. I go see the shows. I review them on TV and radio, but I'm not... I think you're going to spread my wings anymore. I'm quieting down. I'm just relaxing, enjoying life, not pushing too hard. It's been a fascinating life, and maybe the best is yet to come. Who knows? But
what do you look forward to?
I look forward to retiring pretty soon. It's enough already.
And, really?
Yeah. And my legacy will be that I taught these people so much about the world and Americana. They appreciate it.
What are you going to do in your retirement?
I don't know, I'll sit in a rocking chair and enjoy. I think I've enjoyed a good, easygoing retirement right now. I would never go into a nursing home. It's not for me. I got no dementia. I got no Alzheimer's. I'm 100% mentally functioning. And There are people 20 years younger than me, 25 years younger than me. They're in nursing homes right now, and I feel sorry for them, but that's...
You know, I used to work in one.
Really?
Yeah.
As a waiter? You served soup to nuts?
I did. No. I was a waiter there. I brought everybody the food.
Where?
In Long Beach, in Long Island.
Which nursing home?
It was called the Grandel.
Oh, yeah. Still there now, huh?
Still there.
That's good. They got a famous graduate in you.
And absolutely true what you're saying. There were people in their late 50s who I would say are older, mentally older than you, because they let themselves be that way.
I was in a nursing home giving a performance. I still work. I do engagements at colleges. I was in a nursing home about a month ago. So a lady in the front row, a man is falling asleep. A man is sleeping, actually sleeping. And during my performance, I says, "Lady, what's the matter?" She says, "My husband is sleeping." I says, "Well, do me a favor, wake him up." She says, "No, you wake him up. You put him to sleep." Could you imagine? They're pretty shrewd, these people, right?
Yeah, yeah. What do you make of old age? What can you tell me about it?
Well, it's the best thing is to enjoy it, make the best of it. There's no philosophy. You just got to go with the years, go with the punches, and hope you're not going to get sick and not going to get knocked out by the ravages of time, and keep smiling.
What do you think is the toughest part about being old?
The memory. When the memory goes, it's very sad. People, they remember yesterday's, remember what happened 75 years ago, but not what happened yesterday. That's always sad. But the mind is a funny thing. It's just you gotta live with it. That's all. One second. Hello?
Yeah.
Hey, what do you say? Very good to be interviewed here. I'm doing very, very good now. No, no, not...
Really
not when you call. I'm not busy. I love you, sweetheart. I can't do that. 1,010% better. 9 o'clock. Enjoy the day.
I love you,
John. 12 times more, 12 times more. Where'd he go? Where'd he go, Wally?
He's coming right back. He's going to throw out some hot chocolate.
Okay.
All right, so we're back.
Well, get one more hot chocolate.
Okay.
Would you describe yourself as a sensitive guy?
Very, very sensitive. Very sensitive, yeah.
You know what I've noticed about you over the years? And it's not... I'm not saying it as anything but as a commentary. Is that I think you keep... You know, some people wear their heart on their sleeve. You've heard that.
I think many times, right.
Sure. I think you're very good at protecting yourself. I don't think you open yourself up emotionally in front of people.
So true. I'm a very private person. Anything that people want to say about me that's down, I don't want to hear about it. Even if they say it right in my face or to a nearby neighbor, I don't want to listen. I just keep on keeping on with my own happy-go-lucky spirit and my engaging, winning way. Even in my golden years on TV, I could make a very strong acid point. As I could make the same kind of point as a nasty host like a Joe Pine or an Alan Burke or some of these old, or Mike Wallace in his heyday. And people would say, "Did Joe Franklin really say that?" And they said, "No, he couldn't have said that because he's too lovable, too kissable, too much of a baby-faced, lovable." So I got away with it by acting nice.
How do you maintain your positivity?
It's not easy. It could be partly an act. Maybe after the show I get a little bit mean again, but I was never mean on the radio, on TV, never, never. It's a good part of my life, my double life. And something else people never understood about my career, which I've rarely confessed. My whole life is tongue-in-cheek. Everything I ever did in my life on TV or radio was tongue-in-cheek. But you know, you had to be very deep in understanding to realize that I was tongue-in-cheek. I was kidding, putting the whole world on.
I always thought that about you.
But it worked out fine. I was on all those years. Tongue-in-cheek, Joe Franklin, right?
So why were you so tongue-in-cheek? Why not? Were you afraid to be vulnerable?
I was enjoying it. I just enjoyed that kind of a split personality. Someday there'll be books written about me, like Charlie Chaplin told me. People write big books about him. They analyze every move that he makes, every Freudian implication, for example, to simplify things, every time he kicks the fat man in the behind, he's supposed to be knocking the establishment. And he swore to me that those books were in vain because he had nothing in mind except to make people laugh. Nothing in mind except that. So they're analyzing what wasn't there in the first place, you know?
But you certainly keep a lot of you a mystery.
I keep it behind the scenes, right?
Why?
I don't want to disclose it right now. I got time yet. Maybe I'll write a book one day called My TV Career Was a Fraud. Somebody asked me yesterday, what do I want on my tombstone? You know what I said?
What?
I'll be back after a short break. No, no, I said I got a better one. I said, my agent told me I'd be playing better rooms than this.
One thing I picked up about you years ago, observing you, was that you're a lot sharper than you let on.
I try to be somewhat naive, but I understand everything that's going on.
Yeah.
I had a show one time with Joe Pyne. I just mentioned Joe Pyne before. And, you know, he was a famous TV talk show host. And Al Capp, who wrote the famous Little Abner movie script and world-famous comic strip. And they both had wooden legs. Getting into a little argument on the air. You know what I said? I said, General, why don't you take off your legs and fight a duel? That was very bold of me to say that. But it made front pages all over the world. I had John F. Kennedy in the next studio to be doing his debate in 1960 with Richard Nixon. And the guest on my TV show actually died. He started to snort, which I thought was the death rattle. You know, you do get a death rattle as you're dying. So the two gentlemen came running in, Nixon and Kennedy, to try to resuscitate him, but they couldn't. Once again, made front pages all over the world. So I've had a lot of death-defying experiences on my show through the years. I think I died every night on TV for all those years myself.
Yeah.
I would sometimes walk away, though, and let the guests do 10 minutes, 15 minutes all by themselves, which is very bold, very daring. But it worked. Everything I did always worked. And there was a big article in New York Magazine about a year ago that everything that David Letterman does, stupid pet tricks, and everything that everybody does, was originated on Joe Franklin's show. I did everything for everything in the world, I did it first.
And it must make you proud. And yeah, it must also be a little bit gratifying for you to get that credit.
It is, yeah. It doesn't help the bankroll, but it's nice to get that credit. I enjoy it.
Right. Do you ever feel sometimes that you're not given the credit you deserve?
Many times, but I'm left out of many things.
How do you handle it?
I just handle it. I just go with the punches, and I swallow what has to be swallowed, and I never ask for a retraction from any newspaper column, from any guest. I just keep on plugging along.
But why do you think some people's legacies are considered much bigger than other people's? You know, I mean, certainly you've done more work than so many people.
The whole secret in this business, Danny, is who's your agent? I never had an agent, never had a manager. I was asked by William Morris many times that they wanted to manage me and so forth, and I always felt a little bit intimidated. I just never got back to them.
What was intimidating about it?
I didn't want anybody to peddle me. I didn't want my name to be peddled anywhere, you know? Just didn't like to be...
It was a control thing?
I didn't want to be peddled by anybody. I didn't want to be auctioned off. So I had my own way of life, and it worked for many, many years.
So what we do on this show is we pick a different philosopher every week, and I discuss the philosopher with the guest, and they have something in common. So the guy who picks him, his name is Alex. And Alex picked a guy for you named Henry Bergson. Have you heard of Henry Bergson?
Not really, no.
What you have in common with him is that you have a great memory, and he's a philosopher who talks about memory. Bergson distinguishes between two types of memory. One is rote, like riding a bike. It is the physical ability to repeat an action. Then there is pure memory, like the first time that you saw a movie. It can't be repeated, and it's therefore the truest of the two kinds of memories. This shows how the mind and the body are spatially different. The body is always in the present, and the mind is always in the past. Would you agree with that?
I would. I agree. I got a little bit lost there, but memory is a big part of my life. The first movie I ever saw that I enjoyed was called What No Beer, with Buster Keaton and Jimmy Durante. So it ties in a little bit with what he said there.
Yeah, he's saying that, you know, the first movie you ever see would be your pure memory.
That's my purest memory, right?
Your purest memory.
What No Beer, about 1936.
The other memory is based on repetition, like you repeat an action, learning how to ride a bike. The more you do it, the more you remember it. But that's only because you repeated it a million times.
I never rode a bike in my life. I rode a three-wheeler when I was a kid, but never a two-wheeler.
Really?
The accidents going on around town today are just horrendous. I'm glad I'm not part of that scene today.
What about jogging? You ever jog?
A little bit. I was never much of an exerciser. I've got to confess I've been kind of stagnant through the years. But career-wise, no. But personally, yes.
Do you ever drive?
Never had a driver's license. Never had a driver's license in my life.
Never?
Never. I drove a car when I was a kid, but if I gave you a list of things I've never done, Dane, nobody would believe it. I never drove a car.
Tell me some more, yeah.
I never had a credit card, always paid cash. I never played cars, I never played solitaire.
You've never played solitaire?
I never went to a beach.
You've never been to the beach?
Never had my feet in the sand, per se.
What?
Never went to a racetrack. Never went to a... I can give you 20 things that I've never done. I've worked all my life.
This is so fascinating to me. You're a guy who's collected stories from all these people, and you haven't even done these basic things like go to the beach.
So when I hear that, I went to the beach. So if you want to take me to a beach, I say, all right, I'm already what you are, but I never got around to it.
I'll take you to the beach.
I'm ready. In about 10 years from now.
All right, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Henry Bergson, and then...
Hello? Oh, yeah, hold on one second. Go ahead, I'm ready. Go ahead. Hey, Kevin, you want to hear something sad? That was not last night. That was the night before. You'll find last night, okay, Kevin? God bless you.
Here's a little bit about Henry Louis Bergson. He was French. He lived from October 18th, 1859, to January 4th, 1941. So when did you start interviewing people?
I would say about 1947, 48.
You just missed him.
Right, just missed
him. You just missed him. Otherwise, you probably would have known him. I don't think that anybody who was around during your time of interviewing got away.
He surely would have been my guest, right?
He would have been. He was a major French philosopher. He was influential, especially in the first half of the 20th century. Bergson convinced many thinkers that the process of immediate experience and intuition are more significant than abstract rationalism and science for understanding reality. I don't know what that means.
Sounds to me like it was a contemporary of Émile Coué, who said, every day and every way, I'm getting better and better. That was his famous phrase. Every day and every way, I'm getting better and better. And it sounds very much like a Coué disciple. Go on.
He was awarded the 1927 Nobel Prize in Literature in recognition of his rich and vitalizing ideas and the brilliant skill with which they have been presented. In 1930, France awarded him his highest honor, the Grand, and I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong because it's in French, the Grand Croix de la Légion d'Honneur.
That's okay. It's a good reading.
Thank you. Bergson was born in the Rue Lamartine in Paris, not far from Palace Garnier, the old Paris opera house. Have you heard of that?
Of course.
In 1859, his father, the pianist Michael Bergson, was of Polish-Jewish family background, originally bearing the name Bergson.
Mm-hmm.
His mother, Catherine Levinson, daughter of a Yorkshire daughter, was from an English and Irish Jewish background. The Bergsons were a famous Jewish entrepreneurial family of Polish descent. So he came from a famous family. Henry Bergson's family lived in London for a few years after his birth. He obtained an early familiarity with the English language from his mother before he was 9. His parents crossed from the English Channel and settled in France. Henry became a nationalized French citizen. He goes on to talk about his marriage. Here were his works. In 1889, he wrote Time and Free Will. In 1896, he wrote Matter and Memory. That's the one I guess we're discussing because of the memory. In 1907, Creative Evolution. And in 1932, Two Sources of Morality and Religion. In 1900, the College of France selected Bergson to a chair of Greek and Latin philosophy, which he held until 1904. He then replaced Gabriel Tardé in the chair of modern philosophy, which he held until 1920. The public attended his open courses in large numbers. Okay. So, now you got a little bit of background on him. I like to make sure...
Great background, great track record.
Yeah. So he'd be a good interview, right?
I'd like to hear about his marriages. Who was he married to?
He was married to Louise Neuberger.
From when to when?
Let's see. Cousin of Marcel Proust, 1871 to 1922.
Right.
The novelist served as the best man at Bergson's wedding.
Right.
Henry and Louise Bergson, they had a daughter together named Jean.
Right.
She was born deaf in 1896.
Right. That's enough.
So here's some quotes from him, and they're about memory, and I'm going to ask you to comment on the quotes, and that'll wrap up the show.
Okay.
So here are his quotes. The first one: to exist is to change. To change is to mature. To mature is to go on creating oneself endlessly.
I'll agree.
Yeah?
I remember when I was in TV, the censorship problem was enormous. One day, my sponsor was Camel cigarettes. I said, 9 out of 10 doctors who tried Camels went back to women. I was taken off the air for 2 weeks from that line. That's nothing today, right? Hello? 7:30 tonight, you got the big news. 7:30 tonight, guaranteed 7:30. Okay. Wally, let me have a soda. Whatever you got, Wally. Come, Jimmy, come sit down, Jimmy. Is there a chair for Jimmy? Right. Let me have one more cookie. These cookies are pretty good, aren't they? All right. I got it. Hello? 15, 20 minutes, 20 minutes. Yes, I'm doing a radio interview. Call me in 20 minutes.
All right, you ready?
Okay, go ahead.
So to exist is to change. Do you agree with that? Do you change a lot as you get older?
Absolutely. I definitely agree.
To change is to mature. What about that? Do you still think you're maturing, or do you hit a certain age where you've matured and that's that?
I say you never stop growing, never stop learning, never stop acquiring new knowledge, new information.
To mature is to go on creating oneself endlessly, and that's what you're always doing, right?
Precisely.
I don't think you've ever stopped creating yourself and recreating yourself.
And reinventing.
Yeah, and so many people have done a show, and the show ends, and that's that.
But and reappraising, reassessing, and renewing my innermost thoughts, even though they may be a little bit dingy, they're still televisable and radio-izable.
Okay, here's the next quote. The present contains nothing more than the past, and what is found in the effect was already in the cause. I'll read it again. The present, now, contains nothing more than the past. And what is found in the effect was already in the cause.
Well, if Georgie Jessel were around today, Georgie would say, anybody who talks like that, I wouldn't play with him. Well, he's probably a little bit wrong with the technology onslaught now, where people lined up around the mall in Short Hills right now, thousands of people to buy a new Apple iPhone. So it's, I would say the past and the present are somewhat separated, somewhat... going in devious routes, but in his day, that was very true. In his day, nothing changed, but the way it's changing now is very scary. Kids in school don't write anymore. Every kid you see is on the corner with his texting and sexing, and it's a different world. I always wonder how Abraham Lincoln got by without a textbook, a text phone. You know, that's how it is.
And here's the last quote. You ready for the last quote?
Right.
The last quote is this. In truth... all sensation is already memory. What do you think that means?
I'll back it up. There's nothing new, nothing new, nothing really newly sensational. Whatever goes on today that's that exciting, that thrilling, that kind of a gait, that kind of a tempo is not new. It's been done and said and practiced many, many times in the past, many times before. One second, Tony. Hello? Hello? Alan, call me half an hour. Okay.
You've talked to all the greatest stars in your life, Groucho Marx and Hitchcock and Charlie Chaplin and Michael Jackson. What do you think you took away from all these people? What do you think is the essence to life? What do you
think love is- of life, a great respect for their audience, and they never looked down at their... fans in the crowd boxes, and they were what you would call likable factors. They were likable IQs and likable personalities. The whole thing was this, even in politics, you get elected today by on your likable personalities. You got a little smile right and look nice and put nobody down and don't be a jerk.
Yeah.
And
when you talk to all these people, Joe, were you searching for purpose in life? Do you think that's what was underneath it all? Were you trying to find out what life is about?
I think you're right. I picked up. I was well paid for learning things that somebody else would love to learn, without any pay. So I enjoyed every second of it.
Do you believe in God?
Absolutely, 1,000%.
Do you pray?
Every night. Every night.
What evidence do you see for God in the world?
I see so many nice people, happily married people that fight against divorce, fight against brutality. They're happily married. They stay home with their wife and kids, and many homes, of course, are held fast in the baby's hands. Otherwise, that family would break up by now. But that's what happens. But I see goodness. I really do.
Have you seen a shift in terms of when you interview people now? I think a lot more people are atheists in this generation. What do you attribute that to?
If they do, I feel sorry for them. You got to believe in some religion.
Why is it important?
Do you find atheism is rising? Do you think so?
I think so. I'm not an atheist myself.
I don't follow it, but I'm in favor of having a good religion, a good church, a good synagogue, and paying your dues to the great one upstairs.
Do you believe in an afterlife?
Absolutely, yes.
Is part of what you do? Are you striving for this afterlife?
I've got many plans for afterlife. I really do. I'll go into that with you someday soon.
Are you going to interview people in the next world?
Guaranteed.
You can pick up on all these guys that died before you started.
Guaranteed. Fred Allen, Jack Benny, Rudy Valley, Kate Smith, Eddie Cantor, everybody. They're all waiting for me.
Was there anyone you wanted to interview over the years that you weren't able to?
Greta Garbo. Everybody in the world except Greta Garbo. She wouldn't come on with me, but she was a dear friend. We used to go to movie retrospectives together. She would listen to my radio shows when I played her old records, soundtracks. She was offered an open-ended check signed if she would just do another movie or another
really
TV show. She made a movie once, I think, called A Woman's Face or A Two-Faced Woman. But 1941, she saw that movie. She said, I've made enough faces. I quit. Just quit, just like that, cold.
See, I only know Greta Garbo from that song. You know, what was it? I've been invited by Franklin D. Greta Garbo has had me to tea. So she must have been a big deal, I know.
Oh,
that.
She was number one star in the history of the world, Greta Garbo, sure. Bigger than Marilyn Monroe in her heyday.
Who was your favorite interview?
Bing Crosby.
Why?
I always thought of Bing as being what you would call mechanically reproduced. I thought of Bing on radio, on TV, on records, on movie screen. But when he walked toward me, flesh and blood, that day I melted. I think I did my best interview that day with Bing Crosby.
What made
it
the
normally
best?
He was not that... he was normally very cool, very aloof. He would tell the songwriters, don't put the word I love you twice in one song, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
But that day he was so much at ease. I think he was showing off to his wife who was on the panel with me, Cary Grant, you know, Catherine Grant. But he was, and after the show, he went out in the street, talked to a girl, he said, my name is Crosby, you want to do a road tour with me? He was so nice, he was just a regular guy. Yeah. So I think Crosby, out of 500,000 of you, I would choose Bing as number one.
What made the interview the best on your end?
Well, he sang all those old songs from a record album, and he got every word wrong. And he was just Bing Crosby. He was my idol. I always had an ambition to present him at Carnegie Hall, which I never got around to, but he was my favorite.
What advice would you give me as I go forward interviewing people?
Do the same. Don't change a thing about you. You got everything down pat. I really mean that, Danny. Danny,
yeah.
Boy.
You think nothing change?
Nothing change. Not even my underwear. Nothing changes. It's been a great interview. God bless you. Invite me back, Danny. Okay, kid.
I love you very much, Joe.
I love you twice as much.
You know, you mean so much to me, and you always have. And I've got tremendous respect for you.
And vice versa. Otherwise, I wouldn't do this kind of interview for any. The most I do is 6 minutes, 8 minutes. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed every minute of it, Danny. Good luck with your career, with your comedy act, and with your radio show.
Thanks, Joe. I love you.
My pleasure.
All right, everybody, that's my show. Again, I want to say that I wish respects to Joe Franklin's family, and to Joe, I hope you rest in peace, and I hope you're interviewing all those people up there that were waiting for you. I hope you're having a good time in the next world. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for everything. And thank you guys for tuning in.
moderndayphilosophers.net is the website if you want to make a donation. Would be very appreciated. I'm trying to afford a wedding here, so you could help me with that. That would be great. And that's about it. Jump on iTunes. People have not been on the iTunes leaving those comments and those stars. I hate to always push it, but I don't know. If I don't mention it, people don't do it. So please jump on iTunes and leave 5 stars and leave a nice little comment if you enjoy the show, because it doesn't cost anything. It takes a minute of your time, and it does help the show's visibility on iTunes tremendously, which we need. We need that to grow the show and to keep the show going. You get the idea. Please do that. That's it. And I think I'll end this episode just by doing a quick little eulogy, I guess, for Joe. As my impression of Joe, as I remember him. And it's weird. When I went back and listened to this episode as I was editing it, it sounded almost like I knew this was the last time I'd get to talk to him. I didn't know it at the time, but now when I listen to it, I almost feel like we said goodbye. So here's my goodbye, Joe, as you, eulogizing you. All right, I'm going to give this a shot. Joe, you were a wonderful guy, a man of men, certainly a man of men, a king of kings, an entertainer of entertainers, and wonderful entertainer. Very much enjoyed. You were a talk show host. You were a man to watch in every possible form of media. And you were a friend. You were a gentle guy. You were a ladies' man. A ladies' man, absolutely. 110%. Ladies' man and a raconteur. Great raconteur. A wonderful talent. You were sweet person, a sweet man, and someone who helped out a great many people with their careers, including myself, which I'm very grateful for. Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely. You were a great restaurateur, a wonderful restaurateur, and somebody who will be missed. By me and by many others as well. So long for now, Joe. We'll see you at the next interview. Okay, very good, very good. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful.